at the end of my normal 4 years, but the 12 hours were split. I needed 6 hours in the fall and 6 hours in the winter. And as a result of sticking around Eugene for a few more months, I was able to meet a number of law students, and I started thinking about law, but I really wasn't sure that that's what I wanted to do once I was out of the Marine Corps. But as it turned out, there is a class called the Code of Military Justice while I was in the Marine Corps, and that's the class basically that said to me, when you get discharged, you should pursue a career in law. And now, 40 plus years later, I'm looking at the end of my career, but it's been, you know, a quick, as I see it, 40 years.
What was it about that class that convinced you or that attracted you to law?
Well, I guess the easiest way to say it is everyone in the PLC program and at the basic school were all college graduates, and everyone was studying really, really hard for this test. And I said to myself, you know, this is really fairly simple. And once I took the test and received, you know, 100 on it, I realized that this was an area where I might have an aptitude. Mm-hmm. And that's what directed me toward thinking that once I was discharged, I would, in fact, apply for and go to law school.
Mm-hmm. When you look back at your career, Judge Haggerty, what are some of the things you're most proud of?
Well, when I was a public defender, I represented a number of people that ultimately had never had an attorney that they could totally confide in. And many of them told me that I was that person, that they felt they could confide in me and that I would actually represent them to the fullest, even though, as they say, I was not, quote, a real attorney because they weren't paying me. I had a number of clients tell me that the case was such that maybe they should get a real attorney, and I kept telling them I am a real attorney. Also, once I became a judge, I handled some cases that had very high profiles. The Metzger case here back in the 90s, that case was being seen internationally, and a number of judges told me personally that they felt that I had handled that case as well as anyone could have, and that was very rewarding to me from the standpoint that here are people, my compatriots as such, that were saying that I was doing a good job. And whenever your peers tell you that you are doing a good job, I think that speaks more for what you want to hear than what someone that you may not have as much faith in would tell you the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Refresh our memory now. The Metzger is kind of on the periphery of my memory banks here.
Metzger was an individual who was an organizer of numerous skinhead groups. Mm-hmm. And there was an incident here in Portland where Mulgeta Sarah was beat to death with bats by skinheads.
Nah,
and
I
then
remember, yeah.
The estate sued Metzger as being responsible for that death. And I was assigned the case. And before that, I was assigned the case, I had never heard of Tom Metzger or John Metzger. And it turned out to be a case that drew national attention and, as I said, international attention, and it resulted in a verdict for the family of Mulgeta Sarah, and it basically stopped Tom Metzger's programs. He had TV programs, he had newspapers, but it basically curtailed his activities on a national basis.
Did anyone think it was ironic that that an African American will be involved in that case?
I think you might say Tom and John Metzger thought it was ironic. And I didn't. You know, Judge Launder assigned the case to me, and once it was assigned to me, I looked at it just as if it was just a normal case where I had received an assignment. I tried not to do anything any different than what I would do with any other case. And
what do you depend on when deliberations get sort of cloudy or when situations get a little rough? What do you draw on?
Well,
what have you drawn on for the many years?
As a federal judge, you have the ability to hire two or three attorney law clerks. And I have, I believe, relied quite heavily on my law clerks over the years. And I've only had a couple of cases where I truly disagreed with my law clerks. And in those instances, you have to say, well, it's going to have to be my way because, you know, I'm the one that's got to sign the opinion. But most judges, I think, look to their inner self and try to not only do what's right legally, but what's right morally as well. Sometimes you have to write opinions in a way that you reach a moral result. A quick example is I inherited a case of a man that had been in prison for like 10 years. And my first reading of the case said this person should have been released years ago. But under the statutes, there was no basis to release the individual. And I talked with one of my law clerks, and we came up with a plan, and we wrote the opinion such that we released him. And the government did not appeal my decision. So in that sense, it was very rewarding to know that you had done the right thing, even though the law suggested you should do something different. It worked out perfectly.
One of the things that you've been quoted to say is that one of the things you have been quoted as saying is that you look for the right verdict.
True.
What does that mean?
Well, the example I just gave you. Okay. The law said this person probably was going to spend the rest of his life in prison, whereas in my thinking, the right verdict would be for him to be released. And that's the way we wrote the opinion, was for his release. I guess that's the most glaring example of that principle, but...
Now, this is... when you held the Metzger case, that was when you was a public defender?
No, that was when I was a state court, circuit court judge.
Oh, okay.
That was in 1990.
Okay. You're listening to It Takes a Village. I'm Shahid Hamid here with Judge Ansar Lee Haggerty, Senior Court Judge of Federal Court Judge here in the state of Oregon. Judge, how many other African American or Latino judges are currently on the bench in Oregon?
Are you referring just to the federal court, or?
Well, let's start with the federal.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's Judge Hernandez. He's a Latino judge on the district court bench here in the District of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And myself, I think we're the two minorities that are currently on the court here on the federal bench. State court-wise, I'm going to miss somebody, but There's Adrian Nelson. She's a circuit court judge here in Multnomah County. Kenneth Walker is a circuit court judge here in Multnomah County. I've been away from the state court system now for a little over 20 years, so I'm certain there are a couple of more minority and Latino judges throughout the state court system, but I'm afraid at this time I can't call their specific names. I know there are a number of judges now. I'm trying to think, are there any more? Well, I know there are. I just don't recall their names as I sit here.
I'm just curious. You know, coming up, you kind of indicated that your attraction for law began in the military, in the Marine Corps. But coming up as a young man, who were some of your heroes?
Well, if you're asking insofar as legal heroes, I don't think I had any specific ones other than, of course, the TV attorneys such as Perry Mason, those type of people.
Okay.
But I did not know of any attorneys until, I guess, I met some law students at the University of Oregon, and they were en route to becoming attorneys.
Well, not necessarily law, but we're looking at what motivated you. You know, you went to Jefferson School and came up in a kind of a tumultuous kind of situation coming out of Vanport, and you went to the University of Oregon when there was very, very few blacks, I'm sure.
This is true.
There, you went to the military, Vietnam. I personally admire anybody that has the courage to even join the Marine Corps, much less serve time in Vietnam. And so, but what was it that motivated you? What was it?
Well, of course, you have to start with your parents. My mother and father always taught my sister and I, quote, to do the right thing. My real father died when I was 3, and my mother remarried when I was 5. But I've always referred to my stepfather as my father because he basically raised me. And they always encouraged that we participate in as many things as we were capable of participating in, and as I've just said, always try and do the right thing. Both parents were advocates of education, and as you mentioned, Jefferson, I had a number of very good, strong coaches that took an interest in individuals beyond just coaching. I had the unfortunate accident my senior year, and I broke my leg the first day of football practice, and I didn't get to play any high school in my senior year. But
you went out for the team?
No, I broke my leg. I was done.
Okay.
I was done.
Okay.
But my coach took me down to the University of Oregon for their spring football game and introduced me to the football coaches there, saying that I'd had this accident, but I was a very good football player and they should give me an opportunity once I started as a freshman. And I was a walk-on in that sense. I didn't have a football scholarship. But by spring term of my freshman year, I'd earned a scholarship. And as a result of that, I was then able to go through college on a football scholarship, which was very important because my parents obviously couldn't afford to pay for both my sister and I. Yeah. But coaches, even in college, assisted me insofar as direction. Lynn Casanova was the head football coach at the University of Oregon. And when I was preparing to exit the Marine Corps, there was an article in the newspapers that I was thinking about going to law school. But I went down, had dinner with Margaret and Lynn, and told them that I was really not that hot on going to law school, but I wanted him to get me a job coaching. And, you know, he basically said, look, go ahead and go to law school. If it doesn't work out, you know, come back.
You can always come back.
And we'll get you a coaching job. Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, I went to law school, had reasonable success, and proceeded to have my legal career. So you never know what advice you're going to receive, but if you follow it, and it can turn out the way it should.
Mm-hmm. A couple of names I want to throw out at you. You know, we know that you've been passionate about the law. Thurgood Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall was a one-of-a-kind person. He did things that it would be hard to find another person that could duplicate what he did when he did them. To go and argue those cases in the Deep South at a time when it was very risky from the standpoint of your own personal life. Mm-hmm. And then to sacrifice the time and effort to get those cases to the Supreme Court, and then to successfully argue them to the Supreme Court. I don't know, as I say, of anyone that could have done that at the time he did it in the fashion he did with the success he did. So to me, he is a one-of-a-kind person that obviously this country will be ever grateful to for the effort he put forth and the accomplishments he did.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on sentencing guidelines?
Sentencing guidelines are an important factor in criminal law. Up until a few years ago when the Supreme Court rendered an opinion that said the sentencing guidelines are merely advisory, this changed the whole approach judges can take with respect to the sentencing guidelines. You're not locked into a particular number, and you can look at the individual and impose a sentence in accordance with, again, all of the factors that make up that person. So now they're advisory. Judges know and treat them as advisory. And sometimes, even though they're advisory, they still can result in pretty severe, harsh sentences in the federal system. I'm not too familiar with the state court sentencing guidelines because, again, I've been away from them for 20 years and I've not had to apply them. Right. But judges in the state court system, with respect to Measure 11, don't necessarily have much leeway. They're mandatory. If the sentence is a Measure 11 sentence, then they don't have much leeway.
Mm-hmm. Justice Clarence Thomas.
Justice Thomas, again, is a unique individual. He obviously will never have the same stature as Thurgood Marshall. He has said some things, such as when he first was up for confirmation, he basically embraced affirmative action. But I would think it fair to say that over the course of his tenure on the Supreme Court, he has not been a proponent of affirmative action, and that's sort of hard to rectify in my mind, but he is a United States Supreme Court justice, and he will serve until he decides to retire, and hopefully upon his retirement, whoever the president is at the time will see fit to again appoint an African-American person to that court.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly want to thank you for taking your time to taking time out to come down to Cable Studios. We want to honor, of course, those achievers from the past, but we also want to honor achievers in the current, in the present. And we certainly consider you as one of our inspirations, one who can inspire some of our youth. And I understand that you're doing some community activities now, too.
Well, I try and do a few things over the years. I've coached Pop Warner football with a number of schools, Lincoln, Grant, Jeff, and I've worked with the We the People competition, again from high schools, and recently I worked with the Jefferson High School mock court team. And I try to assist young lawyers whenever they come to me seeking advice.
Okay, in a word, because I have to end this wonderful interview. But in one word, what word would you want to be remembered? What word would describe you, your memory?
My one word,
or two or three. But I'm just short on time. That's what.
Well,
I
understand. I would hope that I am remembered as having been a fair judge.
Okay. Just a fair judge.
Just a fair judge.
Well, sir, thank you so much for taking time out to come and share your achievements with us. And we wish you all the success in your retirement and wish you the very, very, very best.
Well, it was a pleasure being here.
Thank you so much. Yours truly, Shahid Hamid, for It Takes a Village. I've been interviewing Judge Ansar Lee Haggerty, Senior Court Judge of the Federal Circuit Court. Until next month, the first Friday, take care.
This is KBOO Portland. That was Shahid Hamid speaking with Judge Ansar Lee Haggerty, the senior district judge of the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon. Coming up next, it's Radio Zine with host Jimmy Tardy. He'll be speaking with the cast and crew of Project Unspeakable, a dramatic reading of quotes from historical figures related to the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert Kennedy. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. And folks who are not yet members can remedy that at kboo.fm when you click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned for Radio Zine.
Has anybody here seen my old friend Martin Luther? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seems a good die young. I just looked around and he was gone.
I'm Jimmy Tardy. I'm joined in the studio here at KBOO by members of the cast and crew associated with Project Unspeakable. I'm here with Marcia Myers, Roger Blackburn, Robert Fish, and Mary Lansing. Thank you all for joining me. Let me go to you real quick, Mary. Project Unspeakable, what's that all about?
Well, the ironic thing about it, Jimmy, is that we are speaking of the unspeakable. It's called Project Unspeakable because we're talking about assassinations.
This play is based on a book written by James Douglas under the same name, Project Unspeakable. And a thing that's very significant about this for me has been that for the first time in my 68 years, this happened when I was 18, JFK's, but I realized that there were 4 assassinations within 5 years. This traumatized a whole generation of baby boomers. These 4 assassinations were amazing events that hit us 1, 2, 3, 4, and we sort of took it for granted that this was part of our reality. So now we're really looking at it, and it's way past time.
This play, which in its entirety lasts about an hour and a half, encompasses the assassinations of 4 people, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. One of the beauties of this play is it's adaptable. We've performed it at an hour and a half in its entirety. Now, tonight we took a 20-minute segment that focused on Martin Luther King. In other places, we may focus on John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. It's an amazing concept in its flexibility, and there are a number of other places. We're going to be doing this around the Portland area over the next year, on the anniversaries of these 4 people's deaths and births. And we are inviting many communities in the Portland area to participate in both bringing this to their church or their group and to participate in the actual reading and performance of the play.
We encourage you to get hold of us if you would like to participate or make this event happen within your own community. You can call me, Marcia Myers, at 503-665-3957, or you can connect with Robert Fish, the director, under Robert, R-O-B-E-R-T, F-I-S-H, at AOL.com, and we will help you make this happen within your own arena.
That information will be available at the webpage.
kboo.fm/node. That's N-O-D-E / 63581.
And now let's go to the reading that you all did just a few minutes ago. A very condensed, shortened segment of this Project Unspeakable, based on a book by James Douglas about the 4 assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, Jr. We'll go to that now.
My friends, thank you for coming. I'm so glad you're here. I need someone to talk to. I've been having bad thoughts. I can't sleep. It started with this one dream. There were all these doctors and nurses huddled around a gurney. But the doctors and nurses were gagged, and they had their hands tied behind their back. Then I realized I was at an autopsy, because on the gurney was the dead body of the president, President Carter. And all around the room were these generals and admirals and FBI agents. The president sat up on the table. He looked me right in the eye and said,
"America does not at the moment have a functioning democracy."
I noticed that my hands were bound like the doctors, and it was hot, very, very hot. There was another man in the shadows, too. I couldn't see his face, but his voice was clear.
"The murder of the president is not a mystery."
"But President Carter is murdered."
"Any citizen who is willing to look can see clearly who killed President Kennedy."
When I looked back at the table, I saw it wasn't Carter. It was President Kennedy. The back of his head was gone. Standing behind him was a black man. He reminded me of Martin Luther King He reached out his hand, and then I knew it was his son, Dexter.
The question now is, what will you do with that?
Do with what? I asked him. Then I woke up. I can't shake this dream. I need to sort it out, but I don't know who to trust. I barely trust anyone anymore. Where did it start? I tried to trust Obama, but he's not doing what he said he'd do.
Which leads to the question, why would he do all those things? Why would he be afraid, for example, to take the drones away from the CIA? Well, I've come to the conclusion that he's afraid.
Who are you?
That's 27-year CIA veteran analyst Ray McGovern, the man who used to personally deliver the CIA's presidential daily briefings to George Bush Sr.
Really? Or am I still dreaming?
Everything you're about to hear tonight that is not a narration is a quote made by the character speaking or has been relayed by someone who was there.
And I know from a good friend who was at a small dinner party with progressive supporters that they asked him, why didn't you do the things we thought you stood for? Obama turned sharply and said, don't you remember what happened to Martin Luther King?
He said that?
That's a quote.
Here's Elizabeth Woodworth, professor and author.
If JFK, MLK, and RFK were assassinated while promoting peace in a military economy, how far can Obama push for renewables in a military oil economy?
So I'm pretty convinced the president is afraid of the CIA. He's got two kids. He doesn't want to get killed.
Oh, come on. He's the president of the United States.
The mystery of President Kennedy's assassination has not been solved in the mainstream press. You need to read James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, and then you need to reflect on Obama.
A witness of a crime who just stands by tends by that very fact to become an accomplice.